From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I'm from Milpitas,
Union City.
Mission Bay.
I do not know where I'm from.
Coming up, a San Francisco writer sees big changes ahead for the Emerald Triangle marijuana industry.
What you have is a black market economy, and it's going to stop being black. So, you know, it's a big question mark hanging over the whole area. What's going to happen next?
Then a dancer from Zimbabwe on the therapeutic power of her art form.
Instead of being sad and being grumpy and put it to all other people, I put it in singing.
And inmates at San Quentin use tech skills to prepare for a different way of life after prison.
I'd been a bully and I had caused a lot of hurt in the world. And now I wanted to give back. I wanted to stop that cycle.
A story about cannabis and a whole lot more today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. If you're into renewable energy and sustainable living, then the Solar Living Center in Mendocino County is your kind of place. It's a demonstration site drawing 150,000 visitors a year, the brainchild of John Schaefer, who's been at the forefront of the Back to the Land movement since the 70s. Today, the center has taken on another purpose. It's got a marijuana dispensary on the grounds, and if recreational marijuana is legalized by California voters later this year, the site could be a centerpiece of Mendocino's new tourist trade, the Napa Valley for weed. That's what Chris Collin wrote about in the April edition of San Francisco Magazine. He sat down with Leah Rose to talk about the past, present, and possible future of the Solar Living Center in this excerpt from her podcast, The Upshot.
John Schaefer, the man who started the Solar Living Center, you talk about that the reason he got into it was because after graduating from Berkeley, he lived for a while on a commune, and he was really one of the first people who was part of the Back to the Land movement. And then he eventually opened some stores and sold supplies where you can actually live off the land. But he ended up getting really, really wealthy. So how did that affect his environmental off-the-land vision?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, to live in California now, when you hear about startups always talking about making the world better, and then they go on and talk about their social media app, he actually got rich actually making the world better. And one of the first things he did that was proved to be huge was discover this thing called solar. Of course, we had solar before that. You know, I think NASA was using it. But he was the first guy in 1979 to buy photovoltaic cells and sell them retail.
What are those?
Those are the solar cells you see on top of a house.
Okay, so the big panels.
The big panels, okay. Exactly, yeah. The thing is, back then it was really expensive, and the only people who could afford it were the people who had a bunch of cash in their pockets, and that was this community up in Mendocino and elsewhere in the Emerald Triangle that was growing weed. And it actually was this sort of little-known history that's starting to come out now that solar in this country, he was the first person to sell solar retail. Solar wouldn't have gotten started were it not for the marijuana growers out there who needed a way to be, you know, getting power off the grid. And vice versa, they would not have been able to get their grows going were it not for solar. So it was this sort of funny symbiotic relationship.
Can you talk about how that relationship between John Schaefer, people who sell solar, and the weed growers, how has that changed now that it's all so much more out in the open?
Well, you know, it's funny. It is and it isn't out in the open. I mean, we live in this weird moment where pot is, like, widely accepted, and it's, of course, legal in a lot of places and sort of legal here. But at the same time, you can still go to prison for it. So they have to do this sort of bizarre dance, which has given it, given that whole area one of the most idiosyncratic economies in California. And I'm going to not answer your question and answer a different question. One of the things that was interesting to me about this is that that's all about to pivot, right? I mean, we're going to have legal pot very soon. And so, you know, this relationship that we're talking about between the pot growers and, you know, operations like John Schaefer's up in Mendocino County, that's all going to change. What you have is a black market economy, and it's going to stop being black. So, you know, there's a big question mark hanging over the whole area. What's going to happen next?
And you wrote that John Schaefer has sort of been on the periphery of the cannabis industry for years, since the late 70s. But last October, he actually jumped into it directly by opening a dispensary up on the Solar Living Center property. And what's different about his dispensary?
Yeah, so this Solar Living Center has been there for 20 years, and a person should go check it out anyways because it's super interesting and fun. But what brought me up there recently was this new development, which is the opening of the Emerald Farms cannabis dispensary. To see like a new bud store in California these days is not exactly fascinating. But what was interesting about this place is, to my mind, it was Schaefer and his crew sort of taking a step forward into what the future of a post-legalization Mendocino County might look like. He already has 150,000 tourists a year coming to the Solar Living Center. You know, by bringing in the marijuana component, that sort of opens up this whole other avenue for people to get interested in. You know, what's when you're up there talking about what will become of this area, and the Emerald Triangle, that's Mendocino, Humboldt, and Trinity County. It's about 10,000 square miles that was recently estimated to be growing around 30,000 different cannabis gardens. That's, I mean, no one really knows, but that's one estimate. This is where, this is our marijuana breadbasket. So, you know, to go up there now and to talk about what the future of the economy will look like, a lot of people are talking about tourism, marijuana tourism, and you see that starting to happen in Colorado and in Washington State and elsewhere. To me, that was sort of it's an interesting question because, you know, the question of whether you can have the Napa of weed, as a lot of people say.
I love that. Yeah, that was great.
You know, it's interesting. Like, on the one hand, you can imagine all these, like, buses full of people who want to see how pot grows and try different strains. But on the other hand, I sort of felt like anyone who has spent a lot of time in Napa can sometimes feel like there's a sameness to some of these tourist operations. And the history in Mendocino County, for example, is just so quirky and interesting. It seemed sort of a shame that would get papered over with bland sort of tourism options.
I'm Leah Rose. This is The Upshot. And today I'm talking to Chris Collin about his new story, The Eden of Weed, for the April issue of San Francisco Magazine. You talked about Mendocino being a quirky place. Can you share any stories that you heard maybe from John Schaefer or from other people who have lived in the county for a long time?
Yeah, this isn't from John, but this is just something you just hear up there. If you know anyone who's ever worked, you know, picking on any of the marijuana grows or just anyone who lives up there, it's a pot economy, and that means it's a cash economy. So you hear about, you know, people having one thing I would always hear about is people having refrigerators full of cash buried in their yards.
Wow. Or, it's like Tony Soprano.
Or walking around with a thowie in your pocket.
A thowie? Is that $1,000?
Yeah.
Ooh.
And so I think sometimes people are sort of cash rich, which shapes life in a weird way. One person I remember telling me, this is more of a Humboldt story I think she was talking about, but it might be hard for you to pay your mortgage, but because you're sort of cash rich on a day-to-day basis, you get this wad of bills and you go buy a kayak. So you can see how little decisions like that change the culture, like, you know, starting with little decisions like that and then sort of branching out.
Would you describe it as a hippie culture?
You know, I think when Rush Limbaugh closes his eyes and pictures Northern California, what he sees is the Solar Living Center. But the truth is, first of all, I don't really know what hippie means anymore. I mean, it's a super sophisticated place with cutting-edge technology and science addressing, like, obviously one of the most, if not the most, pressing issues of our time. So I'm a little reluctant to sort of, like, just sort of slap the hippie label on them. That said, you know, is there a guy down the street selling tie-dye shirts? Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
But the truth is, it's a complex part of California. You have NRA stickers too. I mean, it's rural. So you have this sort of mix of different subcultures.
Did you talk a lot to people about what's going to happen if marijuana does become legal?
Yeah, there's a great deal of anxiety about what will happen if pot becomes legal, or when pot becomes legal. you know, one of the questions is who's gonna come in and make all the money? Is it gonna be Monsanto? Is it gonna be and then how are you know, how does that affect the mom and pop farmers? In a way, it's just another farming story in our country with all the sort of heartbreak or worry about heartbreak that entails.
That was journalist Chris Collins speaking with Leah Rose. It was engineered by Justin Richmond. You can read Chris's article, The Eden of Weed, in this month's edition of San Francisco Magazine. That conversation is from Leah's podcast, The Upshot. Find a link to the article and the podcast at kalw.org. And since it's 4:20 today, that's also where you'll find a fresh cannabis news roundup from KALW's cannabis correspondent, Stephen Short. This one explains the origin of 420. Check it out. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. 2016 marks the 18th year of Bay Area Dance Week, a 10-day free celebration of dance in the Bay Area. Julia Chigamba is receiving the festival's Dancer's Choice Award. Her company, Chinyakare Ensemble, brings the dance and music of her native Zimbabwe to the Bay Area. She joined KLW's Jen Sheehan to talk about holding dance at the center of everyday life.
I grew up, you know, with this music. I'm always seeing it since I was born.
Yeah, part of your culture,
right,
is dance and music. It's just always
it's
around.
It's always there.
And you come from the Shona people in
Zimbabwe,
correct?
Yes. For me, dance is life. It's family. It's community. Because what I grew up seeing around dance and around families and around community, because my mother and my father were playing this music for healing for other families. They were being hired to spend all night playing music, and, you know, people have problems. They want to solve rituals, happiness, sadness. So that's what I see the music is. It holds all the emotions, the struggle we have, the goodness we have, the joy. It's everything is in there. And for me, as growing up, seeing my mother, my brothers, sisters, and my father doing it, I saw that that's the first school that teaches us how you can be out in the world, how you can be relate to other cultures, and how you can know yourself. So for me, when I dance, and when I sing, when I drum, when I'm teaching, I'm not like teaching coming from myself. I'm coming from that energy of healing, of family, of community. That's what I deliver to my dance company to form. And now we have a non-profit organization called Kumusha Foundation. And I named it Kumusha because Kumusha means home. And Kumusha means family. Kumusha means community, where you come from, your origins. And because I saw that here, that when I go to Zimbabwe, a month, 3 weeks, I started missing here. I'm like, but I wasn't born there. But I feel like it's time for me to go. I'm missing burrito. I want like my burrito. I miss, you know, sushi. I'm missing all this. I'm like, wow. So that's my home. So when I'm here, I don't miss home as much as I do when I go home. I'm connected with here now because of how much the people here appreciate the music and how much, especially Chinyakare,
your company.
Yes, how much they love it so much, so deeply. You can feel, you know, from their heart, from their soul, that we get connected together as a family from different people, you know, different cultures. We all come together, and what you see, which what people say, you see family when you are performing.
So it's like you've created another family using your cultural forms to do that, to form it.
Right, which is what I think about, you know, the music and dance itself, that it's bigger than us. It's, you know, I've learned a lot of things of life through it, that I feel that when I'm here, I'm with my mom because of that. When I'm here, I'm with my kids, I'm with the community back home, it's everything you need is into the music and dance. I grew up with not having a lot for my family to feed us all because of 10 kids. You know, having lunch as one cup, black tea, and a piece of bread, one, and that's it. You go to school, no breakfast. You come home, you have that. I remember asking my father, I'm not full. I needed more. I just have this part to just feel myself. My father said, go have a cup of water. You'll be fine. And you go, you have the water. We start dancing. We forget that we're hungry. We are happy and, you know, and excited. But I realized in the dancing, there is food.
Cura, cura one. Ay, signore, cura one.
What I've experienced, that it holds the space that even when you are having a hard time, you can find a place where you can find peace and cry to, which is when I came here, I left my kids in Zimbabwe when they were 9, 7, and 4. Before I left, I used to cry, when am I going to be a mother to raise my kids, to give them school fees and feed them, because my family were doing it for me, because I was a single mom back to the family. It was very hard. But, you know, with all that, it and the dancing have been keeping me, you know, strong, that the songs themselves, we have songs for crying. We have songs for not having things. We have songs for having things. When I sing those, that's where my voice is coming from. And that's where, instead of being sad and being grumpy and being mad and put it to all other people, I put it into that singing. I put it into the dance, and I put it into the drumming. And the people around me, Chinyakare, and the kids I work with and everybody I work with, they kept me strong. All these things, you know, all these people were called by the music. I didn't go and knock. But they heard what I do, they heard the music, they've seen the dance. So all of that, you know, it keeps me strong and keep me going. And those people becoming like a medicine to me, just like the music, that when I look at them, I know they are here for this, you know, and it's just, they just heal me.
That was Julia Chigamba of the Chinyakare Ensemble talking to KLW's Jen Chien. Bay Area Dance Week is being held from April 22nd through May 1st. The kickoff event is this Friday, April 24th in Union Square Park. Best of all, the whole thing is free. Find out more at klw.org and click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. And now we have a story from our partners at the San Quentin Prison Report.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
Bringing you hidden stories from life inside.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell. You see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You can hear a pin drop.
What do San Quentin and Silicon Valley have in common? Geographically, they're pretty close, but otherwise, they can seem pretty far apart. Well, two venture capitalists are looking to bring them together. Chris Redlitz and Beverly Parenti have created a program to bring tech opportunities and coding skills to inmates preparing to leave San Quentin. It's called The Last Mile. At the annual demo day, guests from the tech world come to hear business pitches from the inmates in the program. San Quentin Prison Report producer Lewis A. Scott brings us this audio postcard from the event.
I'm MC Hammer, and this is Hammer Time. I like supporting the community, and as a community, it is our responsibility to lift each other up. Hope and a second chance, that's what it's all about.
My name is Azrael Ford, but everybody calls me Big Az because I'm a giant. And I'm 6'4", 280 pounds. Somebody told me about The Last Mile, an entrepreneurship program that taught inmates like myself about the tech world, you know, create ideas, develop the ideas, and then share those ideas with people from the tech industry. Right when I heard that, it clicked. I was like, that sounds like the program that I want to get into. I'd been a bully and I had caused a lot of hurt in the world. And now I wanted to give back. I wanted to stop that cycle. Imagine how my story about being a young person who became a skinhead and ended up going from the schoolyard to the prison yard would have an effect on young people. Schooligans is online social community where high school kids come and they build their own profiles that allow them to share their personal stories and likes of maybe experiences they dealt with bullying or some of the peer pressure aspects that come up in life, you know, like drugs or teen sex, cheating on tests, ditching school, and get information about the truth of negative behavior.
Brent Choate, Superintendent of the Office of Correctional Education. It's inspirational because it gives me meaning and purpose, because that's what I do in my life, is promote educational programs and opportunities for people to better themselves and change and become employed when they're released. So graduates of The Last Mile are kind of like the culminating activity of what I do. I start with people when they're learning how to read, and then they go through the various programs and get prepared for something like this.
My name is Cheng Kao. I am the founder of Vocal Lock. The reason I came up with Vocal Lock, I use a firearm and I kill someone, and that's the reason I'm incarcerated. Vocal Lock is a gun lock that claps on the trigger housing to prevent firing. It recognizes the owner's voice, and it has a second layers of protection to require the owner to say either a passcode or a password. The primary reason for the gun owner's reluctance of purchasing gun locks or securing their firearms is the amount of time that it takes to unlock defeats self-defense. Kids were saying that, hey, you always look out for my interests. You always tell me not to hang out with the wrong guys. You always tell me to be careful of this, be careful of that. But why would you keep your guns unlocked in the shoebox? Keep it safe, keep it ready, and keep it vocal locked.
My name is Samuel Hearns, and I am the founder and creator of The Village. The Village is an online service that will help accelerate and coordinate the rescue of missing people. This was inspired by my father's story, who was kidnapped as an infant and held captive for 5 years. And I felt like this was an opportunity for me to do something to help others. The app will actually track where people are placing the flyers. It will make sure that the most populated areas have been covered with the flyers. It will also track by way of GPS on the volunteers' phones what areas have been covered, so that if there is a missing area, the coordinators can contact the team leaders and direct them to those missing areas.
Gavin Newsom, Lieutenant Governor of California. All of them had a cause that was bigger than just making money, and that's the one thing that stood out for me that was the most profound and most important. And it was all about connecting a life story and one's their own narrative to reconcile something, not just their own journey in terms of trying to right the wrong, but also looking forward and trying to have an impact broader, more broadly in society. In this world we're living in now, it's going mobile, local, social, cloud, the white waters of change are so rapid that people literally outside these walls can barely keep up. And for folks here that have been you know, incarcerated for 10 years. You know, 10 years ago, Facebook didn't exist. Twitter was still a sound. The cloud was in the sky. 4G was a parking space. LinkedIn was a prison. Big data was a rap star. None of those things existed, and now they're ubiquitous in our lives. And so in this world where it's no longer connected but hyper-connected, this stuff is absolutely fundamental to being able to survive, let alone thrive, when people are out of San Quentin.
That piece was produced by Lewis A. Scott from the San Quentin Prison Report, which is a project between KLW, San Quentin Reporters, and Nigel Poor. For more information on The Last Mile, go to KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. That's also where you can find all our reporting. Our team includes Louisa Cardosa, Lila Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Stephen Short, and Eli Wirtschafter. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by singer Caroline Sky of Marin County. Sky is one of the teens and young adults performing this Friday at the Marin Center Complex in San Rafael. Music starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
The naive are the believers. I'm brave.